My name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. Morning, everyone. I was still getting instructions up to the last moment right there. They said things would get better. I'm still getting instructions like I did in the beginning. 21 years later, I understand the instructions. I need to write a lot of things down. First off, I want to thank the committee at Mount Eagle, the trustees, Grady and Ann, George, Marge, Kevin, Steve for introducing me this morning, Mickey. And there's one individual, that I didn't name in that bunch, because when I mention this individual, I'm going to get monetary compensation for that. And it's $5 for the first time and a dollar thereafter, so somebody keep tabs on this, on how many times I mention Mickey Hawkins' husband. Twenty-one years ago, I came to Mount Eagle for my first time, and I was in real good shape 21 years ago. And since that time, the opportunities for me to share about mountaintop experiences, because something happened that weekend. I met members of Alcoholics Anonymous that practice these principles, that carry this message, that share themselves with people like me, people that don't deserve the good things in life. I met a guy here that took me aside and introduced me to the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he shared this truth with me. Between the covers of that book, I would find the answer to any problem that I ever have. In my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, the journey that I've made, that is more true today than it ever was. Simple 164 pages. It's a part of my life. But also in this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, I share these mountaintop experiences, as times like this, you know, give me the opportunity to pontificate upon the nuances of our vernacular, elevate us to intellectual and philosophical planes of spiritual enlightenment. Doing okay, Jim? But I was introduced to that book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the bottom paragraph to the forward to the third edition tells me about what I'm doing, what we all do. That bottom paragraph states, regardless of great increase in size and span of our fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. That's my duty, that's my mission, that's what I enjoy most in life. Not only the times when I come to places like Mount Eagle and we sit there in the common room till 5 o'clock in the morning and solve all the problems of the world other than our own, and find out everything that's wrong, but the experience, strength, and hope that I've been given the opportunity to share in the drunks that I've seen. And so when really, you know, we can pontificate or we can look for these planes of spiritual enlightenment, I can be, just be human beings, study that book, and carry the message. And as a result of studying that book, I found it was very simple. But in order for me to understand simplicity, I have to talk about another mountain. It seemed there was this man that was endowed with everything necessary for him to be successful in life by society's standards. He had the intellect and the financial means by which he gained an education. This education afforded him the opportunity to join with a giant corporation. He made his moves within that corporation, climbed the executive ladder, bought membership in the country club, the fine, beautiful home, the automobiles. The people in the community looked at this young man and deemed him successful. But this young man looked at his life and realized there's something missing. I must have more than this. So he began a journey to fill this void in his life. And in the beginning, because he had the financial means, he tried the psychologist and psychiatrist and group therapy sessions. expended a lot of funds in this endeavor, and it gained him nothing. He found himself on the streets with groups of people like him, people that were seeking an answer, and they weren't sure what the question was. Running with many different occult movements, going in many different directions. One morning he came to in an alley in that little community he lived in and looked at his life. And he recalled that when he was gaining his education, he had been given a great set of books. And this great set of books introduced him to the philosophers of the world, the philosophers of our time. And he said, if I go back to those books, I will find my answer. So he returned to those books, and he could intellectually understand the words that they shared with him, but he could not apply it in his life. But in this great set of books, there was a study of the religions of the world, and he embarked upon a study of the religions of the world. And one of our Far Eastern religions, he read about a group of men that were referred to as gurus. And what he read was that these gurus had all answers, all knowledge, and all understanding of life. The young man said, that's what I need. I need a guru in my life. So he boarded an airplane that landed in New Delhi, got on a boat that went down a small river. At a bend in the river, the boat docked, and the young man disembarked with his belongings. There was a village there, and the people in the village approached this young man. Now, he couldn't understand their language. They couldn't understand his language. But they had seen many men like him come down this river, and they knew why he was there. So when he posed the question, where is the guru? They pointed toward a mountain. And this young man looked toward this mountain, and between him and this mountain was this vast wilderness. He began to have second thoughts about his journey. And then philosophically, he says to himself, well, maybe I have to suffer some more before I find my answers. So he began his trek across that wilderness. After many weeks of hard journey, he came to the base of that mountain, broken in body, broken in spirit, realizing once again his endeavors would gain him nothing. But as he lay there at the base of that mountain, he looked up, and he saw a small ledge, and off this small ledge there was a curl of smoke, and he said, that's where the guru lives. Rejuvenated in spirit, he climbed that mountain, came to the base of that ledge, and there was a ladder, and he climbed this ladder and stood upon the ledge, and looked upon an elderly man that was sitting in a lotus position, meditating upon the setting sun. The young man said, guru, what must I do to find peace, happiness, serenity, and understanding of life? The guru broke from his meditation upon the setting sun, looked to our brother and said, don't drink and go to meetings. My first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous on the last Sunday in August of 1970, and I had similar questions about what I must do with my life. And those people shared with me that simple philosophy, don't drink and go to meetings. Within myself, I cried out, no, you don't understand. You don't realize what kind of person I am. That's not the answer that I seek. But one day at a time, as I walked this path, I look back and realize don't drink and go to meetings was more of an answer than anything I could ever conceived or created of my own. Because they knew where I came from and they knew what I was. All the barriers of life, all the barriers of society were down, and they shared with me this message, don't drink and go to meetings. And in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I followed that philosophy, and fortunately I came to a thing called sobriety. And there's been times within this journey that I've gone beyond sobriety. There's been moments when don't drink and go to meetings and this thing called sobriety and practicing the principles and staying up all night and drinking too much coffee and all the other things that we do that seem to be a part of our life in Alcoholics Anonymous came together, and just for one flashing second of time, I felt so whole and so clean, and I said, you know, that's worth it. That's what it's all about. If I could maintain those moments. But you know, then I come back off of that mountain and go back into life and drinking too much coffee and staying up too late and pontificating and searching planes of spiritual enlightenment, and then it comes again. The thing about it is, as I look at my experience, those moments that I found, I never planned them. That was not my intention when I began to walk that path. I did not create these things, they just happened. And how does it happen? I shared Thursday night in the little meeting over there in the common room about what Alcoholics Anonymous gave to me when I came here, and I met a beautiful lady named Neely. She was a member of my home group. She was sober longer than I'd been alive when I first met her. And I created the barrier that was there, you know. But she shared with me Alcoholics Anonymous and the little home group that I grew up in. They taught me how to do things. They taught me how to be of service in a simple way. I'm going to share about recovery this morning. In a sense, I qualify to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And because on this date, 21 years ago, I said I want to be sober, I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the jails, as I was sharing with Jim last night about getting kicked out of the Navy because I was such a drunk. And pardon the pun, but that's a feather in my hat. To find the United States Navy where drinking is a tradition. Drinking and fighting with the Marines and all those things, and I did those things. And my service record records that he is such a drunk that we don't know what to do with him, and so they kicked me out. The times in jail and the things, you know, but is that what makes me a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? What makes me a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is I have a desire to stop drinking. Not because I qualify to be here, not because I've got that thing in my past that all of us have shared, and the jails and the broken homes, and the pain and the agony, the guilt, the remorse, the fear. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I have a desire to stay sober. And I want to share that with you because that's important to me. It took me a long time to understand that. As I used to go around in the early days and try to recruit drunks to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there's something more to it than that. But this little lady, Neely, shared with me this program. Very kind way. And I didn't belong with her. She was sophisticated. She was intelligent. She was well-known, well-respected. And here I was, just a little drunk that never got his hair cut, and I guess I smelled strange at times, and I didn't talk too well. And she knew what I needed. And then there was a little bald-headed, dried-up old man that shared with me Alcoholics Anonymous as he understood it. Papa Joe. In my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will share this with you. I'm a very shallow person. I don't have a lot of things in my life. See, I've only had one sponsor, and that was Papa Joe. I don't have a sponsor for economics and one for jobs and one for relationships and one for which meetings I go to and which part of the book I read. I just got Papa Joe. And I don't know, maybe I missed something there. What it would have been like to have five or six sponsors to direct my life or share with me. But see, Papa Joe shared with me the truth. And then that's another thing that's important to me. Sometimes I see it today, and to think I watch people that play games with this thing that saved my life. You know, it's a mutual admiration society. And I hear people say, well, you know, some of the old-timers share with me, well, it's not like it was what it was because, you know, we can't find the drunks anymore. And the book told me that if I can't find them, go look for them if they don't come to me. And I found them that way. One morning in Snellville, I'm sitting there drinking a cup of coffee, and these four people behind me are taking this individual of their church inventory, and they're talking about, you know, well, we gave him the money, and he said he was going down the road, and then he doesn't remember anything after that. And I said, yeah, I can identify. And so I turned around and introduced myself. My name is Paul, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it seemed like you got somebody that I'd like to talk to, or maybe he'd like to talk to me. And the call was made, but that's as far as we got. But I found a drunk, and God has saw fit that every time that my life gets such a point that I lose my direction and my sense of being, that God brings me a drunk. But let me share with you a little bit about some of these times that I've gone beyond. They took me into the Northeast group in Atlanta and had me do little things, you know, empty the ashtrays and clean up the coffee pot and sweep the floor. And I didn't want to do that. That's not the reason for my being in life. I wanted to be somebody. And they didn't hammer on me to do that. They just said, this is what you do. And then Wednesday nights, they told me I could set up the meeting. There were elderly people there, and they couldn't move the tables around, so I was given a job of moving the tables around. And time went on, and they gave me other responsibilities in the group. And one night, I missed a meeting for some reason, and they elected me secretary of the group. And I was told by Neely that one of my responsibilities, secretary of the group, was making sure the chairman were there and the speakers and the things that were, the structure of the group. She said, but the most important thing you do as secretary, Paul, is you stand at the back door, and when the people come in from other groups and other parts of town, and you welcome them to the Northeast group. I didn't want to do that because, see, I didn't like to talk to people. Those people in my group, I was comfortable with them. They knew me. They took care of me. I was their little grandson. I was their little pet. And I didn't want these people coming from the Decatur group over there taking the attention away from me and from the Skyland group. And I wasn't good at talking with people. Neely said, stand at the back door and greet those people when they come. Tell them welcome to Northeast. And so when they would come in the door and the door would open, I would extend my hand and say, hello, welcome to Northeast. And I'd look at people's feet and begin to notice what kind of shoes people wore in and think about that. And as time went on, and pretty soon I could look at a couple belt buckles and then some, what kind of ties they were wearing, if they were in ties, and then one day I could look them in the face. And said, welcome to Northeast Group, the best AA group in the world, and we're glad to have you here tonight. And introduce them around. Is that part of this intellectual planes, this spiritual enlightenment? Is that what we work for? Did I go to a mountaintop and sit down and find a certain position as the sun comes up or goes down, whatever you're supposed to do? Did I read all the great books of the world? No. This little lady said, if I stand there at the back door and greet those people, she didn't say what would happen to me. She didn't say that within myself one day I would have enough good feelings about myself that I could project them to another human being, that I could care about them being there. She didn't tell me that. She said, stand back there and do this, Paul. And I did that for a while, and then one night they asked me to get up and share with the group, and that was a mistake. But I get up in front of the group, and I'm going to share with them my experience, strength, and hope. And I look back in the corner of the room back there, and there was a gal sitting back there. And I remember when she first came in that back door, and I extended my hand and said, welcome. And she came with a couple of gals from the Decatur group. And she wasn't in real good shape, and she didn't smell too good. And we got a cup of coffee, and we sat her down in a chair, and in like we do, we hovered around and took care of her. And I remember that. And this night when I'm getting up and sharing with my group, I look back there and it's not the same person. Something has happened. There's a glow about her, the sparkle in her eyes. And she's still a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's still with us. And all at once as I'm standing there, it hit me. I'm a part of that. What if I hadn't been standing at that back door and extending my hand? No simple thing, the simplest thing I could do, the only thing I was capable of doing. And I'm a part of that. I gave of myself. And as a result, she's sitting back there and she has found and has what we have. And for just that second, whatever it is, I can't even describe it. Is it gratitude? Is it serenity? Is it wholeness of spirit? It captured me, and I said, yeah. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, you know, that's what it is. Mountaintop experiences like Mount Eagle are part of it. And the good feelings when we see a drunk we haven't seen in a while and we hug and talk with each other and those kind of things, that's part of it. But, you know, I stood there for that moment and said, I'm a part of that. You know, I can do something in life. I can give of myself and somebody else can benefit. And that wholeness of spirit comes. And Tody and I went to these meetings and did these things. And on March the 4th, 1973, God saw fit to give us a son. And I'm in, it's 4 o'clock in the morning over at DeKalb General Hospital, and I'm sitting in a room that they had reserved for me. And this little phone rings, and I answer the phone, and they tell me I have a son, and my son and my wife are doing fine. And then I walk out in the hallway, and they bring this little tea cart around the corner, and I saw my son for the first time. And again, you can see Tody and I got married 6 years before we came to Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. I said, Tody, maybe if we had some children, maybe that would give me something, a motivation in life to change. And we never had any children. And I realized today, and I even realized then, that if we had children, I would have done the same thing to them that my parents had done to me. I would have given them the same fear and the guilt and the remorse and the shame. Because I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just thought, you know, I can fix this thing, I'm okay. And so my son has never seen me drunk. Now he's seen me crazy and insane like a sober alcoholic will be. And he began this journey with us. And if any example that I have of Alcoholics Anonymous and the spirit that we have here works, I see it in my son. Because he came to meetings and he didn't come with all of this wall around him, that this thing won't work for me, and don't look at me, and don't touch me. I don't want any of it, but I'm going to come every night anyway. He came here with that innocence of a child, and he sat in the meeting rooms, and he captured the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he shares it. Tody and I talk about it, and his relationship with his friends, the goodness that he has of sharing with him, giving of himself. And it makes us feel good. And we were not responsible for that. We say we brought him to the meetings and you people gave him what we have. And of course, then I told you my home group asked me to get up and share one night, and I said it was a mistake because I haven't shut up since. And, you know, and then what you do is you get an agent and they get you better things other than just your home group and birthdays. And I was given the opportunity to share it a couple places. And one night I'm down at the area assembly in Macon. And the meeting's going on and the podium is all lit up and the rest of the room is darkened. And there's 600 or 800 people in that meeting room that night. And there's a coffee pot in the back of the room, and I'm headed back toward the coffee pot, and I'm trying to find things in the dark back there, and out of the shadows comes this big old monster, about like Steve. Great big, I mean, I could tell he was there. And he said, your name is Paul, isn't it? And I figured, whoa, you know, the mind begins to click real, the wreckage of the past coming to collect, and... and I said, yeah, I'm Paul. And he said, Paul, I want to thank you. He said, my sponsor gave me a tape of one of your talks, and it saved my life. And he hugged me, and he turned to walk away. I don't know who he is. I don't know. If I had to find him, if the most important thing in my life, or me depending upon continuing on, was to find him, I could not continue on because I don't know who it was. And I think about that. Another one of those moments. When I stood there and I said, hey, this thing is for real. But see, when I share these things about this, I not only is the thing for real, but the responsibility we have as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I think about that gal in the back of the room and my son that's never seen me drunk and this shadow that comes out of nowhere and tells me I saved his life And all I did was share with him what you shared with me. You see, we deal with life and death. In what do I share? The hope and the promises and all the words that we use, but what I really share is I share myself. And sometimes I'm scared, and sometimes I'm afraid, and sometimes I'm lonely. But you told me that, you know, I don't have to be that way. And I am that way sometimes. But then I can always return, and I always hear the same thing that I heard the first time I got here. And what Papa Joe often shares with me is, you know, have you asked God, what does God want you to do? And so I share a program of spirituality. No, not religion. I mean, there are certain things that I do within, that are religious context, because I go to meetings and I read the book and I have time for my prayer and meditation. And that's religious in a sense, because it gives me discipline. It gives me a pattern of life. But the spirituality is the conscious contact that I have. And the many times that these things happen to me, God's going to take care of me. God wants the best for me. God loves me. And how simple is the example of how much God loves me? Because I read another book. It's not conference approved, but I look at it anyway, and I understand a lot of things in it. But there's a story of the prodigal son written by a doctor named Luke. And he tells about this guy that goes off and messes his life up, and he comes back, and he's coming back home to his father, and his father's sitting there on the front porch, and he looks off over in the distance and he sees his son coming, and the father runs out to greet his son. And being analytical like I am, or just being stupid, I don't know which one it is, I wondered, I said, you know, what was the distance between the father and the son that day? What was the scenario like? Was he on a mountain sort of looking down into a valley? And I try to imagine, would that make good visual contact that I could pick out, or he could pick out this person many miles away, or such distance away, or was he in the valley, look up the hill? Was it a flat plain? And, you know, I play games with that. That's not what the story told me to do, but that's what I did with it anyway. And why did that prey on my mind? Well, I went to Stone Mountain High School one afternoon because our son, Ryan, had made the 8th grade football team. And I was proud of that, but I mean, everybody made it. I mean, everybody signed up, made the team, but I was proud of the fact. Proud of the fact that he made the football team, and I drive up to watch this first practice session. And I drive into the parking lot of Stone Mountain High School and look across the parking lot, and there's a practice field over there, and then they're down there running around doing whatever you do at football practice. And these guys got on white pants and in red jerseys and white helmets. No numbers. 64 of them running up and down doing whatever they do. And I stepped out of my car and looked across that expanse of space there, and I picked up my son. Because, see, he was part of my life. I love him. I share with him. I want him to have the things that I never had. I want him to have the best. And I'm willing to make those sacrifices that he has the best. He has a better life than I do, not just materially. A place to come to and somebody he can talk to, and I put my arm around him and tell him I love him, and those kind of things that I never experienced until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm standing there in my car looking across this expanse, and then I picked him out because I know his mannerisms. He's just not something that happened in my life, and I got a responsibility to take care of him. He's somebody that I look at. And then I realized, hey, you know, this expanse between the father sitting on the front porch looking out at the son, it's not measured in time. It's not measured in distance. It's measured here. And I can't measure that. God loves me, and he looks across whatever expanse I put between me and him and tells me each day that he loves me, and he wants me to have the best. Well, see, as Ryan and Toadie and I moved out to Stone Mountain and got involved in things, I got involved in a thing called the Stone Mountain Youth Soccer Association. See, I took Ryan up there, and he kicked this little ball around, and I watched him, and I wanted to get out there and play with him. That was the truth. And I asked around, and they told me the only way I could get out there and play with the kids was to agree to coach a soccer team. And so being having these tendencies about my personality that, yeah, I will take a team. And then I began to plan the speech I would make as we received the trophy before being world champions. And so I took these little kids, and we took this thing, and I didn't know anything about soccer. And 16 seasons later, the kids tell me I still didn't know anything about soccer. But I take these little kids, and we go through those exercises and kick this ball around and do this and that. And, you know, and we're going to become world's champions, or champions at whatever level little kids and their goofy coach become champions at. We went through four seasons. We had 2 wins and 38 losses. And the speech that I had prepared for accepting the trophy, I mean, I had lost it somewhere in the house. So we didn't, you know, that's not what I had planned. My plan was we were going to take this and we would just become world powers. But then I realized, hey, you know, the kids enjoy what they're doing. There's kids that want to play on my team. We don't win a lot, but we have fun. And I'm standing up there on the soccer field waiting for these little kids to show up, and I wonder, you know, what am I doing here? And I look down in the parking lot, and the kids are coming, the parents are driving up, and the kids are jumping out of the car, and they come running up the hill, and, Coach, what are we going to do today? And, Coach, I got a new pair of shoes. I'm going to play better Saturday. And, you know, Coach, can we do this? Can I play over there instead of over here? And all this deal. And, of course, you know, I ran a undisciplined, disorganized mess of guys. That's... I'm thinking about it. If those parents knew what I was, would they let their kids come and play with me? And then I look back at my life. The door is always open. And I look back and I think about when I grew up in that small reservation in South Dakota, and I used to leave the reservation and go into town and get drunk when I was 12 and 13 years of age and pass out in the alleys and the sidewalks. And somebody would pick me up and bring me home. And I would walk down the streets of the village the next day, and the parents would grab their children and pull them back and say, you don't play with him, he's gotcha. And that means exactly what it sounds like. And when I was in the service, you know, here we were, I dressed like all of those guys, and we talked the same way, and we had the same thoughts and ideals about life, I guess. And we were fighting with the Marines and fooling with the girls. But, you know, there was a time when I was alone, and it was not very much of a time had passed from the time I first reported aboard my ship and the time that I left. You don't go on liberty with Wahoo. He'll get you killed. He's crazy. He's insane. And they would lie to me. I'd say, you know, you want to go to the M Club tonight, and we eat dinner and play the slot machines and get drunk and go chase some girls or something. Now, I'm not going on liberty tonight. And I'd get over there, and I'd be by myself, and then I'd see them. So why do these people lie to me? And over 100 times that I came to in a drunk tank in the city of Atlanta during a 6-year period, and I would lay on one end of the drunk tank, and all the winos and drunks were on the other end of the tank. They wouldn't even associate with me. Until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, until I practiced this thing called Don't Drink and Go to Meetings, until I took that book and learned it, I was never a part of anything, even though I was just like them. And I'm standing on this hill thinking, you know, if they knew what I was, would they let their kids come and play with me? And here I am, I'm right in my element, right where I belong. I got 8 and 9-year-old kids that are just running around my feet, and we're just having fun, and boom, all at once. Hey, this is what it is. That's what all the great books in the world were ever written about, was just this moment that I'm so whole and I'm so clean and I'm so right. And the only way anybody ever knows about that is if I share that. But that's... You know, the times when I've gone beyond sobriety. And I didn't plan them. I didn't say, as a result of doing this today, this will happen. All I did was follow those instructions. And I talk about this beautiful lady named Neely because she was important to me. And I want to share a story about her anonymity. And Dave, I'm sharing this for you because Dave missed it the other night. The dog stories do not come from this podium. Yeah. But see, Neely was had the ability to look at me, this sophisticated lady that was intelligent and educated. And if society had the choice about us, I wouldn't even have been able to sweep her driveway, because that's what society says. I wouldn't have been able to be a yard man at her home. But yet she took down the barriers and offered me a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And our 12th tradition states that. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And I used to look at that 12th tradition and I said, you know, it says more than I could say that I saw Joe at a meeting and he said he was a drunk. And that's important. That's real important. But you know, if it's a spiritual foundation, there must be more to it than that. And it's from Neely that I learned about the principle of anonymity. And from my grandfather, when I was 7 years old, shared with me this story and told me about it before he had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hadn't even taken my first drink. He says, in the northwestern part of our country, there's a tree that is known as the Douglas fir. And if you've ever stood before a forest of Douglas fir, you could be awed by their majesty and perfection. They grow straight to the sky like an arrow, 200, 250 feet tall. And you walk in this forest of Douglas fir, and every one of them is the same. And you say, that's the way it's supposed to be. But deep in the forest, you come upon a little tree that perhaps as a seedling gets some disease, and it does not grow straight and tall like the other trees. And armed with all what you've already seen and what you already know, you look at it and say, it does not belong. It's bent and it's crooked and it's ugly. But if we can look beyond that which we know and that which we see and realize in the perfection of the creation, there's a hole in the sky where the tree was supposed to grow. And through that hole in the sky, the rain and the sunshine can come through. And all over the forest floor, there's nothing but pine needles, except in that one spot where the ugly tree grows. And because the rain and the sunshine can come through, the weeds, the grass, and the flowers grow. Its imperfection creates beauty. Let me look beyond that which I know and that which I see and allow you to be what you are and nothing less. And hopefully you will look at me and allow me to be what I am and nothing more. As I walk along in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been a bent and crooked and ugly tree. And I've seen many bent, crooked, and ugly trees, and I've seen many straight and tall ones. And all of us are a part of life. All of those things are necessary. The people that shared with me Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning, and they told me to continue with this thing, continue to give it away. And countless things would happen to me that I couldn't even describe, and I didn't want to believe them. I didn't believe them. And enough opportunities to come to places like Mount Eagle, enough opportunities to go to places like my home group at Northeast, enough opportunities just to find a drunk at the Waffle House, and we talk about this thing. And I got better. I didn't plan it that way, because, see, my idea was that if I'm going to come in and do this thing, I'm going to be president, or somebody's going to give me an award for it. And I worked for that. I strived to do that, but then I found out there's too many people ahead of me that were trying to be president and work the awards, and I didn't have a chance. But when I share simplicity, I share this. I take the 12 steps, and they're a part of my life. I utilize the principles that I learned from them personally, and I work them. The first step is as important today as it was 21 years ago when I was trying to understand it. The traditions, if you fussing about things going on in your group, take the traditions down and look at them. You know, it's always easy to say, well, if we got a problem in our group, we'll just kick the problem out. Or I'll go someplace else and start my own group. If you got problems in your group, take those things called the 12 traditions and look at them and the principles they teach us and utilize them. But Tody and Ryan and I, both of us grew up in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and our life is good. God shows me each day that He cares about me and He loves me, and He gives me guidance and direction even when I don't ask for it. And He allows me to be me. And that might be the greatest gift other than sobriety that was offered to me here and given to me, was that I can be myself. Now I know who I am. It's all been said sometime somewhere before. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds, whose breath gives life to all the world, hear me. I am small and weak. I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty. Make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things you have made, and my ears sharp to hear your voice. Make me wise so that I may understand the things you have taught my people. Let me learn the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. And give me strength, not so that I can be greater than my brother, but so that I can fight my greatest enemy myself. And make me always ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes, so when life fades as the fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame. Fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous, little wife Tody, and higher power of my understanding, I thank you for my life.